For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, last week we saw the 10th plague finally breaks through and breaks Pharaoh down. We've been studying the book of Exodus, the second book in our Bible, a story of how God rescues the people of Israel from their bondage and slavery to the Egyptians. And after pounding them with 9 plagues, we finally see the 10th one broke through, a plague of death upon the firstborn of each family that did not mark their door with the blood of the Lamb. We studied that, the original Passover, last week. We saw Israel celebrate the first Passover. This was the act of faith that God called on the nation to do, to mark their door with the blood of a perfect, spotless lamb. And that God says when he reached the household that had the blood on the door, that he would pass over and on to the next household. And we saw how that's a picture of what Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God, would one day do, and how he would rescue us from the judgment that God was going to bring. We saw God's people assemble for their journey to Sinai. Remember, you know, up until this point, it's been the challenge has been getting the people out of Egypt. In Exodus 13 through 19, it's their journey from Egypt over to Mount Sinai, the place where God originally spoke to Moses and gave him this mission. And he said, here's one way you'll know that I've sent you, is when you're back here on this mountain worshiping me, then you'll know that I'm the one that's called you and I've done all this. And so the next 6 chapters are really a journey down to Mount Sinai. We're going to spend 3 weeks covering these. And that journey really starts here tonight. And so now that God has rescued the Israelites, he's displayed his mighty power, everything should be pretty easy, right? I mean, you know, now they've got the most powerful God, the only God, the Creator God, on their side to provide for all of their needs, exactly when they want them provided for and exactly the way that they define those needs, giving them all the answers that they need, satisfying all their curiosity. Not really, actually. What they're going to start to learn about what it means to follow God. And it might not quite be what we think it is. And some of us, you know, we've become believers in God. We've been cleansed by the blood, as we talked about last week. And yet we're finding that a life following God maybe isn't quite as easy as we expected. Let's start reading in Exodus 12, a verse we skipped over last week. He says, "That night the people of Israel left Ramesses and started for Succoth." It's hard to even know where these locations are. These names have been lost long ago, and so I do have a map later that'll take our best stab at the journey that they traveled, but it's really a matter of conjecture as to exactly the place that they're talking about. He says there were about 600,000 men, plus all the women and children. A staggering number. I mean, we got to think about this, you know, 600,000, you know, and that word men is not just men. It's not just like these were all the dudes, but it's actually, it should really be soldiers. So there would have been men that were too young to fight and also men that were too old to fight. And so the total is really quite a bit higher than that. You know, if you figure for every soldier, for every fighting man, you know, there are probably 3, 4, 5 other Israelites. You know, if half of their nation is women, statistically, plus some are too old or too young to fight, you know, it really implies a total population of 2 to 3 million, if this number is right. A really high number. You know, some people read numbers like this and it just throws the entire account into the land of fantasy. Like it lacks credibility. I mean, think about, by comparison, you know, the total population of Egypt during this time, during the New Kingdom, was only 1.5 to 4 million. That's everything, okay? So that would have been, you know, either 100% Israelites or almost 100% Israelites would have comprised the nation of Egypt at that point. I mean, the slaves were getting numerous, so they were a threat, but it's hard to believe that there were, you know, 2 or 3 times as many, or even as many Israelites as there were Egyptians. You know, even the ancient city of Rome only had 1 million people. And that wasn't, you know, for another 1,500 years. Remember, the Israelites were all living in the land of Goshen in one particular part, one particular region of Egypt. Modern Chicago, so they basically would be the entire population of modern Chicago, 2.6 million people. Again, if this number is correct. Or to put it in terms maybe it's a little easier to understand. So here's the shot. And this is about, this holds about 20,000 people when it's completely full, okay? Now that's only if like the wealthy alumni in the front row show up. And you know, you can't really see the part where all the students sit, that dark part along the top, the nosebleed seats. But even that, you know, that would be 20,000. Okay, so what you'd really need to do is, you know, Israel at this time could sell out the shot, what, 50 to 60 times over, fill the whole thing up. So it's a huge number here. No, way more than that. 50 would just be a million people. 5 times 10, yeah, right. So we're talking 100 to 150 times over they could fill up the shot. So, and like I said, part of the problem with this is you know, people look at that and they're like, this whole thing must be made up. So let's think about some other problems with, you know, if the nation is really that big, 3 million people. You know, Deuteronomy 9, here's what God says. He says, you're crossing over the Jordan today to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you. Great cities fortified to heaven. And so there's these 7 different nations over there that he refers to as greater and mightier than them. And so is it really true that these tribal people groups, that they had, you know, each of those 7 nations had 2 to 3 to 4 million people? I mean, now we'd be talking 20 to 30 million people. Modern Israel only has about 8 million people, including all ethnic groups combined. Deuteronomy 7. God will use this same power against all the people you fear. Why are they so terrified if they have such a numerical advantage over the nations that they're going to have to battle with? You know, you've got the fact that most of the time, and there's a couple times, like we'll read about a few of these next week, where God provides, by miraculous means, he provides water for these people. But most of the time, it appears that, you know, God was not providing miraculous water, but they found water without a miracle. What about Leviticus 8, where he tells Moses, I want you to assemble all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting. I mean, even under a representative, you know, from each tribe or something like that. I mean, that really wouldn't capture what he's saying here. It seems like, well, I want everybody to get together here. And Exodus 15, we'll read next week. They stumble upon this area that has 12 springs and 70 date palms. And they're just like thrilled that they finally found some water and some shade. Again, it's like if this is 3 million people, 2 to 3 million people, that's really not going to make too much of a dent. Just the logistics of a group that big are astounding. So what do we think about this? What's a solution to this issue? Well, one thing is to consider that the word thousand is the word eleph, the Hebrew word eleph. And so really what the text reads is this. There were about 600 elephs of soldiers plus all the women and children. 600 elephs. And that word aleph actually has a pretty wide range of meaning. You know, there are times where it did come to be translated thousand. But the word can mean clan or family, and there's tons of examples of this. A guy named Wenham goes through all the different ways this word is used and the ways it can possibly be used, the range of meaning. Clan or family, though, he cites several examples like this, like Gideon in Judges 6. He says, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. That was his tribe. And I'm the least in my family. So, you know, it doesn't really make sense to say my 1,000 is the weakest in Manasseh. We're like the weakest 1,000 in all of Manasseh. Or what about Joshua? Gad and Manasseh answered and spoke to the heads of the families of Israel. So they're speaking to the families or the clans of Israel. There's a bunch of different instances where it's used this way. Definitely not used to mean 1,000 in those instances. The word actually, the development of this word actually started out, most people think it started out meaning ox or oxen. And it actually be used for ox or oxen in several different passages. And then, you know, farmers, they would need like one male and they'd keep a bunch of females around that male. And so it eventually came to be mean herd. It means cattle in some places in the Old Testament. Or a group, and so it was just kind of their word for a big group that eventually came to take on other meaning. And so, you know, under that arrangement, if it's 600 groups of soldiers, of varying sizes instead of 600 thousands of soldiers. That would be a lot different picture here. One author, Doug Stewart, he says, if there were 12 soldiers per group, that puts you right around 7,200 soldiers, and it puts you more like 30 or 40,000 Israelites. Another author, actually Wenham, in his paper, he postulates a little bit of a larger army with more like 70,000 Israelites. How big was the Israelite population? I don't know. I mean, there's some authors that hold to that, and they argue God supernaturally provided for them and stuff like that. But I think there's internal clues, like some that I mentioned already, that point to, a smaller number here. I'm not going to be dogmatic about this. It's still a really big group. I think it was probably closer to the estimates that these guys are throwing around, and not the 2 to 3 million number. So some authors are like, Moses just exaggerated by a factor of 10 for the glory of God or something like that. And I think that is way out of bounds for our reading of Scripture. I'm much more likely to think maybe a copyist error, a series of copyist errors or something like that. I kind of lean toward this explanation here. So, on this night, Yahweh kept his promise to bring his people out of the land of Egypt. So this night belongs to him, and it must be commemorated every year by the Israelites from generation to generation. And so he's been talking about this festival they were to hold every year, Passover and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And in chapter 13, he goes on to explain some more of this. I'm not going to read all of it, but verses 1 and 2 kind of sum this up. Yahweh said to Moses, "Dedicate to me every firstborn among the Israelites. The first offspring to be born of both humans and animals belongs to me." God says, "I spared your firstborn, but now they're mine." All right? I saved them. Now they're my firstborn. Both humans and animals, it says. Now, does that mean they're supposed to sacrifice their firstborn? No. He explains this process of buying back. He says, for animals like lambs and goats and stuff, that the firstborn of those actually should be sacrificed. I don't want you to ever forget this. Now, they could eat the sacrificed animal, so, it was still a meal for them. But he says, like a donkey apparently was in a different category, maybe bought back from Yahweh by presenting a lamb or a young goat in its place. So if you have a donkey, it's my donkey. And if you don't buy it back, you must break its neck. So he says, I don't want anybody using my donkey unless you buy it from me. Okay, so it's like God has this donkey shop, all right, where he's selling firstborn donkeys. and people as well, I guess, is what he's got there too. He says, you must buy back every firstborn son. There was not that option for sons. Like if they didn't have a lamb, they couldn't afford to buy the donkey back, but he's like, that is not an option for your kids, obviously. I'd be sick. In the future, your children will ask you, what does it all mean? So again, there's this element of their kids asking them later, and he says, you'll tell them, with the power of his mighty hand, Yahweh brought us out of Egypt, the place of our slavery. Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, so Yahweh killed all the firstborn males throughout the land of Egypt, both people and animals. And we talked about the ethical problems with that last week, so you can get that if you got problems there. But he says, this is why I now sacrifice all the firstborn males to Yahweh, except that the firstborn sons are always bought back. So he keeps bringing that up again and again and again, the buying back. He says, this ceremony will be like a mark branded on your hand or on your forehead. It's like, when you got to remember something and you write it down on your hand, or you write it backward on your head in the mirror. He says, I don't want you to ever forget this. I want this to constantly be right in front of your face. It's a reminder that the power of Yahweh's mighty hand brought us out of Egypt. And so as Christians then, as God's people now under the new way of God relating to us, this principle still applies. 1 Corinthians 6:20 says, you've been bought with a price, therefore glorify God with your body. And so the way we live our lives, because God has purchased us with the blood of Christ, we live our lives as people who've been bought back, who've been what the Bible calls redeemed with blood, the blood of Christ. And so our whole lives are lived under the shadow of what Christ did on the cross, where he died in our place as our substitute to purchase us back out of slavery and death. Well, back to our story then. When Pharaoh finally let the people go, God did not lead them along the main road that runs through Philistine territory, even though that was the shortest route to the promised land. Well, that's another verse used by some people to say, well, the Philistines weren't around until, you know, 1100s or something like that. And so this obviously must have been made up later and written back in. Not so. You know, the Philistines are known as the sea peoples. The sea peoples, meaning the people that came from the sea. And they actually lived over in Greece and even in Crete. And they landed on the shores there in the southeast Mediterranean and then became a pretty formidable opponent. There's evidence that, you know, even though they were living on Crete at the time and in that area, they still actually had settlements there on the north, the northern part of Egypt, just east of Egypt, for farming. And they would farm and they would bring crops back to the mainland. And so God said if the people are faced with a battle, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. Well, there was a pretty well-traveled road there, but God says, no, we're not ready for that yet. So God led them in a roundabout way through the wilderness toward the Red Sea. Thus the Israelites left Egypt like an army ready for battle, organized into its groups, not equipped, not trained, and yet they marched out. Well, here's a map of Egypt. You can see Egypt is there in the top left, and there's Ramesses where that red line starts. You know, this was the road that would have been the quickest and most natural way for them to go to the promised land. The way of the Philistines, it says there. That's where the Philistines lived. There actually would have been several Egyptian military outposts along the way as they left Egypt, along that land as well. And God says, look, I know these people. I know they are not ready to face they hadn't faced an army yet, remember? These were all judgments God was leveling on the Egyptians, but they never had to square up against the vaunted army of Pharaoh. And so he says, we're not ready. We're not going that way. Instead, we're going to go this way. And so they go kind of south and east. And eventually, you know, they're going to cross the Red Sea and then end up down here at Sinai. But, you know, they're kind of wandering around. They're still within the border of Egypt. It's like, let my people go, and they just kind of wander around right on the outskirts of Egypt. And, you know, Pharaoh would have been getting reports back as to, you know, from his military intelligence as to where the Israelites were at. And, you know, what is God doing here? Does he not know what he's doing? No, he actually knows exactly what he's doing. It's a trap. Not a trap for the Israelites, but a trap for Pharaoh. The Israelites are kind of like the bait in the trap. On their way out, though, it says Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. For Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear to do this. Who is Joseph? Well, Joseph was the reason why they were in Egypt in the first place. He had a very high-ranking government position. He was the great-grandson of Abraham. And he was the one that hooked the Israelites up with that sweet part of Egypt called Goshen that was really fertile. And, you know, but what Joseph says at the end of his life, it's interesting. If you read Hebrews 11, it's a long list. It's known as the Faith Hall of Fame. And, you know, of all the amazing things that Joseph did, the one thing they single out about him as exemplary faith, as it says, when he was about to die, he said, you know, one day God is going to bring you back into the promised land. And I want to be buried there. I don't want to be buried here. He says, in spite of how good things seem now, I know what God promised Abraham, that we're going to be actually enslaved here for 400 years. And then we're going to go back. And he says, I want to go back with you because I want to be buried in the promised land. So he was looking ahead to the promises and not looking at, you know, what his eyes and his ears, you know, could see and hear. And so he made them swear to do this. So they go and they dig out Joseph's coffin. It was probably in a tomb or something like that. And Moses would have been ready for this. He would have been prepared for this because he knew what Joseph had asked him to do. And so 400 years later, or probably more like 300 years later, no, 400 years later, you know, he reminds them of how Joseph said, God will certainly come to help you. And when he does, you must take my bones with you from this place. And so here they are walking out with the bones of Joseph, just like God predicted would happen and just like Joseph predicted would happen. So the Israelites left Succoth and camped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And Yahweh went ahead of them. He guided them during the day with a pillar of cloud, and he provided light at night with a pillar of fire. Well, that's pretty cool. So you've got this visible manifestation of God's presence. By day, it looked like cloud. By night, the cloud apparently glowed. I don't think it was like a cloud and then a big flame. I think it was just a lit up cloud at night, which would have been pretty nice to have out in front of you. But if it's given you some confidence that God is still with us, it's evidence of the supernatural. It's allowed them to travel by day or by night. So at any time, God could, you know, they couldn't travel at night back then. It was way too dangerous. But at any time, God could say, well, it's time to go. And he would flip on the headlights and they would head off into the night. Yahweh did not remove his pillar of cloud or pillar of fire from its place in front of the people. So he kept it there. And then Yahweh gave these instructions to Moses. All right, God, where are we going next? What's going on here? He says, I want you to order the Israelites to turn back, and to camp by Pi, whatever, between Migdal and the sea. So some places we don't know where they are. But it's next to the Red Sea. And I want you to camp there. And so they're kind of between, it looks like some kind of mountain range and the Red Sea. Camp there along the shore across from Baal Zephon. And so God here has deliberately led the Israelites into an impossible situation. A foolish move. Why would you lead yourself into a box canyon, into a dead end, where you can't get out in any direction except the one by which you came in? Only a fool would lead them down this path. And, you know, some of us, you know, we might feel like God has led us into an impossible situation right now. And, you know, people have different explanations. You know, maybe this is Satan's work and that's why things are so bad in your life. Or maybe you didn't follow God closely enough. Well, here it was God's will for them to be stuck with no way out right here with their backs up against the Red Sea. Well, this is too good for Pharaoh to resist. God tells Moses, which is what he's supposed to tell the people, then Pharaoh will think the Israelites are confused. They're trapped in the wilderness. So this was his announcement he was supposed to make to the people. We're going this way, so Pharaoh will think that we're trapped and will think we're dumb. And once again, he says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart and he will chase after you. We talked about this a little bit 2 weeks ago, but this idea of God hardening Pharaoh's heart. I'd like to show you a chart that demonstrates the way that this Hebrew word is translated in the entire Old Testament, in this form of the word. Okay, this is kind of hard to read, but I've given you some labels here. The top, you know, 10 uses or so are Exodus. And then the rest of the Old Testament is below that. And I don't know if you can tell, but this word is translated harden only in Exodus. And in the rest of the Old Testament, it's never translated harden. So it's always hardened in Exodus, and it's never hardened anywhere in the rest of the Old Testament. You know, there it's like repair, encourage, strengthen, fortify, help, give courage to. And so what's going on here? Part of what might be happening is translator bias in the translation of this word. Where in Exodus it's translated hardened, but everywhere else it's translated to strengthen or encourage. It makes it sound like, you know, God decided that, you know, Pharaoh could not let the Israelites go, even though he really wanted to. And the Egyptians could not let the Israelites go, even though they wanted to. And God is wrestling their free will and forcing them to do this. That's not what's happening there. God is strengthening them, and Pharaoh primarily, to do something that Pharaoh already wanted to do. And so once again, I will strengthen Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after you. You know, for him to continue to pursue here would be totally insane. No rational person would continue to chase after the Israelites under these conditions here. And yet Pharaoh really wanted to. And God's like, you know what? I'm going to somehow, it doesn't tell us how, I'm going to give you the courage you need. And, you know, if you really want to do that, then go for it, buddy. And I know you want to. And so basically God has the bait here on the hook, the Israelites, and he's just dangling it out there. You know, he's like, and he's just kind of letting it sit, waiting for Pharaoh to take the bait. He says, I planned this in order to display my glory through Pharaoh and his whole army. He said that several times already in this book. After this, the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh. Remember Moses' first interchange with Pharaoh? Pharaoh says, who is Yahweh? I don't know your God, and I will not let the people of Israel go. Well, now they're going to know who Yahweh is. They're never going to forget about him. So the Israelites camped there as they were told. Well, when word reached the king of Egypt that the Israelites had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds. What have we we done letting all those Israelite slaves get away? They asked. Well, I think that they may have already begun to feel the Israelites' absence at this point. We don't know how long this may have been, several days or even a week or two. It's 2 months from leaving Egypt to arriving at Sinai. And so it's possible there are already work stoppages. People are like, man, where's my bricks? I don't know. We don't have any bricks. Our brick makers all left. And so they may have already begun to feel this. And so they decide not to go to kill the Israelites like the Israelites thought they were going to do, but actually to go to re-enslave them, to bring them back, and to have them do what they were doing before. They've got a pretty short memory. You know, there was a reason why they were insisting that the Israelites leave. Although under, you know, their religious system, you know, maybe our gods are with us now. Maybe they got it together. Maybe we've been pleasing to them now, and maybe they're finally going to step up and do what they're supposed to do. So Pharaoh harnessed up his chariot, and he called up his troops. He took with him 600 of Egypt's best chariots, along with the rest of the chariots of Egypt, each with its commander. So his best chariots and all the other chariots. They basically got this fleet of chariots. You know, foot soldiers wouldn't have caught the Israelites. This was a chariot thing. And the chariot, man, the chariot was basically like, you know, a chariot was to a foot soldier as, you know, a German tank was to the Polish in the beginning of World War II. I mean, there was no standing up against what, you know, this masterpiece of technology. And Yahweh hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. So he chased after the people of Israel who had left with their fist raised in defiance. They remembered, man, how they left and how arrogant they were and how defiant they were and how bold they were. And they were just so smug that their God won. And you know what? I'm going to go get them. The Egyptians chased after them with all the forces in Pharaoh's army. All his horses and chariots, his charioteers and his troops. Well, that translation is a little misleading, but it's just the chariots that are going after him, the troops mounted in the chariots. And the Egyptians caught up with the people of Israel as they were camped beside the shore near Pi Hahiroth across from Baal Zephon. Right where they were, it wasn't really catching them. I mean, they were just sitting there waiting for Pharaoh to come to them. And as Pharaoh approached, the people of Israel looked up. You can imagine how must they have felt as they heard the thunder of the hooves, and then they saw well over 1,000 chariots trampling the ground and everything in their path and coming right at them within a cloud of dust. You know, did they stand there and say, look, our God has protected us before and he will protect us again? Sadly, no. They panicked when they saw the Egyptians overtaking them, and they cried out to Yahweh. And they said to Moses, why did you bring us out here to die in the wilderness? Weren't there enough graves for us in Egypt? What have you done to us? Why did you make us leave Egypt? Egypt actually at the time had about 3/4 of their land dedicated to graveyards. And that's part of what that's a reference to. Didn't we tell you this would happen while we were still in Egypt? We said, look, leave us alone. Let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It's better to be a slave in Egypt than a corpse in the wilderness. So all of a sudden, everybody's like, see, I told you this would happen. I pleaded with you to not set us free from this captivity that we loved. I wanted to stay. I went along because everybody else was going along. And now look at what you're gonna get us killed. At least we were alive in Egypt. Well, they're wrong on two counts at least here. One, they're wrong that the Egyptians wanted to kill them. The Egyptians just wanted to do exactly what they're proposing here. Go back to Egypt and be slaves, okay? What they're also wrong about is the notion that God would not protect them. Again, so it's not just the Egyptians with short memories here. It's the Israelites also that have pretty short memories. I mean, granted, they had never faced an army before, but this is God we're talking about, who had already brought his judgments on and embarrassed every single one of the gods of Egypt. And yet here the people are shrieking and whining and complaining to Moses. You know, hard times start and the grumbling begins, the selective memory begins, and all of a sudden my old life wasn't so bad. But Moses really, and this is really, I think, Moses' finest hour up until this point of leadership. Moses stands before the people and he says, don't be afraid. Just stand firm and watch Yahweh rescue you today. The Egyptians you see today will never be seen again. Yahweh himself will fight for you. Just be still. This is one of the principles you're going to have to understand if you're going to follow God, is that Yahweh is the one that fights for you. It's not that you do nothing. It's not that you won't be scared, but Yahweh fights on your behalf. He is the one that supplies the power. And there's really three commands here that he gives them. First of all, he says, don't be afraid. A common refrain in the Old Testament and the New, fear not, is what you often find God saying to his people. Don't be afraid. Not because things aren't scary on the surface, but because of who God is. That's what he's pointing to here. You know, with our fears, there's nothing wrong with having fears, as long as you don't listen to them. The problem arises when we start to take the counsel of our fears, when we start to let them call the shots. We've got to have a category for talking back to ourselves, for talking back to our feelings, and saying, no, this is what's true, and this is what I'm going to choose to believe. And that is what Moses is calling on the Israelites to do. He says, I know you're scared. Moses would have been scared here too. But he says, do not be afraid. Don't be afraid. He also says, stand firm and watch Yahweh rescue you today. Stand firm. And so the need to not run, you know, I mean, think about, some of them would have been tempted to run. You know, I mean, imagine what would happen here, though, to the guy who takes off shrieking, whoa! Trying to find the nearest mountain cave. You know, I'm just going to hole up in here and wait it out for a couple of days. Well, he's going to come out to a surprise, isn't he? It's only those that stood firm, that hung in there with the Lord, based on his promises, that got to see God's deliverance. Stand firm. I mean, you know, Moses had already told them this was going to happen. God had predicted this. You know, if anything, they should have been relieved when they saw Pharaoh's chariots come over that hill. Because that just was another reminder that God is in control, God is the one calling the shots, and God has a plan. What should have worried them is if Pharaoh didn't show up. Because then what's that say about God's word? Third and finally, he says, just be still. So not only are they to not run away, but to stand firm. But they're also not to fight, not to brace themselves, but just to be still. To stand there. I mean, and again, you got to imagine just standing there watching 1,000, 2,000 chariots, the most powerful army in the world, stampeding at top speed over the hill, across the plains, right on top of you. I mean, you'd have to be, on the one hand, you have to be a crazy person to not flinch, to not try to do something, to not at least make some sort of an effort. And yet this is how God saves us. He says that, you know, you can do nothing to save yourself. It's Christ alone that provides our rescue, that provides our deliverance. And as it says in Psalms 46, verse 10, be still and know that I am God. It's only when we cease striving, when we come to the end of ourselves, that we can truly see the power of God come through. And so Moses is holding it together in front of the people. Brilliant leadership here. Sometimes you're going to have to do this as a leader. You can't, you know, wear your heart on your sleeve. You may have to go and complain to God, but have a strong face in front of the people that you need to lead. And apparently he was crying out to God, whether that was in his heart or something he goes and does immediately after this. But God says, why are you crying out to me? Tell the people to get moving. You know, sometimes your prayer for direction is just glorified whining. You're praying for direction, you're praying for strength, and God is like, why are you still sitting there? Pretending like you don't know what you need to do, pretending like you don't know my promises. Come on, you're just gonna feel worse and worse the longer you sit there and whine to God about your problems. He says, come on, pack up camp. We're going. Well, where are they gonna go? They're gonna go through, is Pharaoh's army gonna somehow get thrown into confusion so they can pass through? Are they gonna be able to pass through the mountains on either side? Certainly, you know, in their minds, there's no way they could pass through that sea behind them. That was the least negotiable of all. But God says, pick up your staff and raise your hand over the sea and divide the water so the Israelites can walk through the middle of the sea on dry ground. Well, that was an option I don't think anybody had considered up until this point. And sometimes when God leads you into an impossible situation, it's because what he wants to show you is that with man, with humans, this is impossible. But as Jesus said, all things are possible with God. Where God has a way out that you have no idea about. And it's not until you're there and you're terrified and it seems like, you know, all is going to be lost. You know, the timer on the bomb is ticking down 3, 2, 1 before God steps in and comes through. You know, it's not until that point that your faith really is tested a lot of the time. He says, I will strengthen the hearts of the Egyptians and they will charge in after the Israelites. My great glory will be displayed through Pharaoh and his troops, his chariots and charioteers. When my glory is displayed through them, all Egypt will see my glory and will know that I am Yahweh. Who is Yahweh? He's going to show them. And then the angel of God, who'd been leading the people of Israel, moved to the rear of the camp. So this pillar was actually the angel of God that we saw earlier, which we argued in Exodus 3 that, you know, that's God the Son, Jesus Christ, was in that cloud. The pillar of cloud moved from the front and stood behind them. It's the same thing, the pillar and the angel of God. And the cloud settled between the Egyptian and the Israelite camp. So it moves around from over the sea to the other side and creates a barrier. As darkness fell, the cloud turned fire, lighting up the night. But the Egyptians and Israelites did not approach each other all night. So they basically have this temporary barrier here to give time for the Israelites to pack up camp. But, you know, I mean, in their mind, they're still stuck. You know, I can imagine the Egyptians going up to the cloud and taunting them through the cloud. They're stuck. They're not going anywhere. You know, if Pharaoh, it's possible Pharaoh took off at this point, actually. He's not talked about in the rest of the narrative. He figures my best chariots, my best soldiers, my best troops are here. They can finish this off without me. Who knows how long this cloud's going to stay here. But they're trapped. We got them. Then Moses raised his hand over the sea, and Yahweh opened up a path through the water with a strong east wind. And the wind blew all that night, turning the seabed into dry land. So the people of Israel walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground with walls of water on each side. Well, that would have been a hot east desert wind that came through there to push back the water and dry out the ground. And this is kind of hard for some of us to take, walls of water on each side. You know, some people are like, all right, I'm done. Check, please. This is mythology. You know, some people will try to explain this by saying, well, you know, really, the Red Sea really should be translated the Sea of Reeds, which would have really just been a marsh, you know, maybe 6 inches of water with a bunch of reeds, and that's really what the wind came through and dried out and parted that. Well, I mean, I guess that's a fine explanation. Now we just need to explain how the entire army of Pharaoh drowned in 6 inches of water. How there were walls of water on each side. You know, this is a miracle. And if you think about it, though, if there's really a God who created everything, then how hard is it for him to part a Red Sea? A Red Sea that he created, filled with water that he created and put there, and for people that he created to pass through. And so really what this boils down to is, how do you spell God? Whether you spell God with a big G or a small G. And if you spell your God with a big G, then this is no problem here. And these miracle stories, once we've admitted there is a God who created anything, you know, any other miracle would be less than that. Well, then the Egyptians, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and charioteers chased them in the middle of the sea. So at some point that cloud withdrew. And the chariots of Pharaoh are standing there looking at not the Israelites cowered against the edge of the sea, what they expected. That was the last thing they saw. But now what they see is a tunnel, a massive walkway through the Red Sea with the Israelites maybe 3/4 of the way through. Well, it says, God hardened their hearts, remember? And, you know, again, to rush down into something like that, you'd have to be insane. And God says, I'm giving you the courage to do what you really want to do. I mean, I guess the alternative, I mean, what are they going to do? Go back and report to Pharaoh? We didn't get them because, the Red Sea parted and they went through on dry land. So we turned back. You know, they had their orders. And so they went in. They also knew the Israelites were loaded down with Egyptian plunder and wealth. And so they knew there's a lot of money in it for them. And so they chase them into the middle of the sea. But then it says, just before dawn, Yahweh looked down on the Egyptian army from the pillar of fire and cloud, and he threw their forces into total confusion. So right before sun up, all of a sudden things start to go bad. They're confused. They start having car problems. Their chariot wheels are twisted or they come off, making their chariots difficult to drive. Let's get out of here, away from these Israelites. Yahweh is fighting for them against Egypt. Yeah, no kidding. And so they're thrown into a defeatism and a despair, and they begin to try to retreat in their chariots that don't work. And then it says, when all the Israelites had reached the other side, Yahweh said to Moses, raise your hand over the sea again, and then the waters will rush back and cover the Egyptians and their chariots and their charioteers. So as the sun began to rise, so all the Israelites could see, Moses raised his hand over the sea with the staff, and the water rushed back down into its usual place. Who needs an army when you got the sea? The Egyptians tried to escape, but Yahweh swept them into the sea. I kind of imagine the water kind of starting at one end and then just waves crashing into each other, running the entire length of the corridor. The waters returned and covered all the chariots and the charioteers, the entire army of Pharaoh, at least the chariot part. Of all the Egyptians who had chased the Israelites into the sea, not a single one survived. So there may have been some that didn't go in. But of all of those that went in, not a single one survived. Again, God is saying, you know, he's giving people a choice. And he's letting them deal with the consequences of their choices. But the people of Israel had walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground as the water stood up like a wall on both sides. That would have been really something to see. I've got a short movie clip here, if it works, of 2 minutes out of The Prince of Egypt, the part where Moses parts the sea. So you get kind of a sense of how unbelievable this would have been. So let's kill the lights and run the footage here. All right, come on now. Jeez.
This staff you shall do my wonders.
God says, let my people go. He means it. That's how Yahweh rescued Israel from the hand of the Egyptians that day. And the Israelites, they saw the bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the seashore. A sad day, an act of judgment. Although, you know, if those Egyptians would have made it to the other side of that sea, there would have been a bloodbath. They would have slaughtered many of those Israelites and then re-enslaved them. When the people of Israel saw the mighty power that Yahweh had unleashed against the Egyptians, they were filled with awe before him, just a sense of amazement and wonder. It's no surprise that they put their faith in Yahweh and in his servant Moses. You know, they had already trusted in him, and yet imagine the unbelievable leap forward that their faith would have and should have taken after witnessing something like this. It's only when you're stretched beyond the limits of your faith. It's right on that edge when you're wrestling with doubt, when your heart is racing, when you're wondering, is God really going to come through? When you're wrestling to believe, and then you see God come through. That is when we see our faith grow. And that's what God does for the Israelites here. And then it says that Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to Yahweh. Chapter 15 is a song that he wrote, a poetic account to capture this victory. And he writes it right there, shortly after the events happen. They teach it to the people. And this became basically like their national anthem that they would have been singing all the way through the desert. And for decades, for generations to come, the song of Moses. I'd like to read through this song for you and just make a couple of points, but just to see what this teaches us about God, Moses' theological reflections on this. He says, "I will sing to Yahweh, for he has triumphed gloriously. He has hurled both horse and rider into the sea. Yahweh is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation." So there's really three things there, isn't he? He's my strength, because human strength is nowhere near sufficient to do the kind of things that God wants us to do. Nowhere near enough to save, to rescue. It's going to take his strength. But he's also my song. And so that's a reference not just to the strength that God provides, but to the joy God provides. The happiness that he brings into our lives as we follow him, as he's rescued us. The good things that he gives us. He says, he is my song. He is the one that makes me want to sing because of how good he is to me. And it says, he has become my salvation. So this is where the goodness of God and the power of God meet in the salvation that God gave the Israelites that day and the salvation that he's extending to anybody here who's willing to receive it. He says, this is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. This is not something we made up, but this is the God who's been with us for a long time. The God who is faithful, the God who keeps his promises. Yahweh is a warrior. Yahweh is his name. God's a fighter. You know, in a world that's hostile to him, there's times where he's got to step in and fight. We're going to see that next study as well. Pharaoh's chariots and the army he has hurled into the sea. The finest of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. This was the elite forces of Pharaoh. The deep waters gushed over them. They sank to the bottom like a stone. Your right hand, Yahweh, is glorious in power. Your right hand, Yahweh, smashes the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you overthrow those who rise against you. You unleash your blazing fury. It consumes them like straw. Well, the God that we've made up is not like this. You know, what is Moses saying here? He's not saying that God is a majestic God, but, you know, sometimes he has to judge, or that the two are incompatible. It is, in fact, a sign of his majesty, a sign of his greatness, that he judges, that he overthrows those who rise against him, that God eventually will destroy anyone and anything opposed to him. He will not allow evil to go on forever. He's patient. He's given every chance here. And yet, eventually God says enough is enough. He draws the line and he judges. And that's what he did here. At the blast of your breath, the waters piled up. The surging waters stood straight like a wall. In the heart of the sea, the deep waters became hard. The enemy boasted, "I will chase them. I will catch up with them. I will plunder them and consume them. I will flash my sword. My powerful hand will destroy them." But you blew with your breath and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who's like you among the gods, Yahweh, glorious in holiness, awesome in splendor, performing great wonders? You are the God who is there. You are the God who is different. There was no one and nothing like you, God. You raised your right hand and the earth swallowed our enemies. And he says, with your unfailing love, you lead the people you have redeemed. In your might, you guide them to your sacred home. You know, that's a promise he makes to you as well. If you're willing to become one of his people, God will lead you. You'll become one of the people who he's redeemed, a person who he has brought back from sure death, from certain doom. And not only will he buy you back, but you'll become one of his own. He will lead you, and he won't stop until he guides you home. The peoples hear and tremble. Anguish grips those who live in Philistia. Here's the impact it's going to have in the future and all the other nations looking on. The leaders of Edom are terrified. The nobles of Moab tremble. All who live in Canaan melt away. Well, we read 40 years later in the house of Rahab that she's heard all about this event. And she says, our hearts have melted in fear. There's no way we can stand up to a God like this. She places her trust in Yahweh. Terror and dread fall upon them, and the power of your arm makes them lifeless as stone until your people pass by, Yahweh, until the people you purchased pass by. Again, God purchasing his people. He says, you will bring them and plant them on your own mountain. So we've seen God has purchased the people. He'll bring them to his place, the place Yahweh reserved for your own dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, that your hands have established. And Yahweh will reign forever and ever. So Yahweh has purchased a people, he's brought them to his place, and he will reign forever and ever. And that's really the theme of eternity future. God's people in God's place under God's rule. Miriam the prophet took a tambourine and led all the women as they played the tambourines and danced as she teaches it to the ladies. The women's part, apparently. And Miriam sang this song, sing to Yahweh, for he has triumphed gloriously. He's hurled both horse and rider into the sea. The first two lines of the song, referencing the title of the rest of the song. Pretty cool. So in conclusion, parting the Red Sea. Parting the Red Sea. What did it mean? What did it do? Well, for one, Pharaoh's army suffered a decisive defeat. Pharaoh lost his most mobile troops, the jewel of his army. And this defeat would leave the Israelites safe from Egyptian meddling for a long, long time. You know, if they wouldn't have been trapped in that impossible situation against the sea, he would have just led them out along the road, that wouldn't have happened, would it? God's people grew in their faith as a result of God parting the Red Sea. You know, at a time when many were doubting and even the ones that believed were still pretty scared, they saw God come through in ways they never expected. And they trusted him more, both God and God's man, Moses. Others heard and believed too. I mentioned Rahab and the impact it had on her. And she says, everybody's talking about this. Four decades after this event. Many other people heard about this as well. Israel continued to sing of this event for over 1,000 years. Throughout the rest of the pages of the Old Testament, you see time and time again. You see in the Psalms, you see in the, a prayer of David, you see a prayer of Nehemiah, you see a speech in the book of Judges, you see Rahab's speech. Time and time again, the focus continues to point back to possibly the greatest thing God ever did, short of the cross, up until that point. The God who is there, the God who really acts, the God who led his people through the Red Sea, conquering both nature and the most powerful of human opponents at the same time. So Israel continued to sing about this so they would never forget it. And the Bible tells us that you will sing about this too. Again, I'll end with a quote from the book of Revelation, chapter 15. He says, I saw before me what seemed to be a glass sea mixed with fire, and on it stood all the people who had been victorious. And they were singing the song of Moses, servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, which we read about last week. And that one goes like this. Great and marvelous are your works, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations. Who will not fear you, Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy, and all nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous deeds have been revealed. Sung by people from every tongue and tribe and nation, praising God, reflecting on how awesome he is and how his rightness has been revealed once and for all, forever. His people in his place under his rule. I'm going to be pretty excited to stand next to Moses and sing the song that he wrote. And to stand next to the Lamb and to sing the song of the Lamb, Lord. Thank you that you are our strength and you are our song, Lord, and you are our salvation. Thank you that you will lead the people that you have redeemed, God. And thank you too, Lord, that what you're calling us to do is not to go out and become worthy of your love or to fight our own battles, but you're calling us to trust you, Lord. You're calling us to fear not. You're calling us to stand still, and you're calling us to trust in you, Lord, to fight our battles and to provide our salvation. Thank you for that, Lord. Thank you that you're such an amazing and powerful God and that you're on our side. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.